Welcome to Close Play. I'm Tevis Thompson, and in this first episode, I'll be talking with Carolyn Pettit about The Witness. Carolyn is the managing editor at Feminist Frequency, and she's a writer I've long admired for her willingness to be open and vulnerable with the game she plays. The game we'll be discussing, The Witness, is the first title by Jonathan Blow's studio, Thecla, and it's the long-awaited follow-up to his breakthrough hit, Braid. It's a puzzle game set on a mysterious island, much like the best-selling 90s adventure game, Myst. Carolyn and I spoke for almost 3 hours about our experiences with The Witness, about the context of our lives while playing, about what a contemplative video game might look like, and about whether single-solution puzzles are a dead end for gaming. The following is an edited version of our conversation, cut down to about half its original length. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you, Tevis. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. I guess I'd like to just start with your experience of the game. What was playing The Witness like for you?
Well, initially, because I was coming to it with associations to Myst, I initially felt a really pleasant sense of kind of solitude on the island in The Witness, which reminded me that was such a powerful part of my experience with Myst. Myst at the time was a game that felt very much like a refuge for me. It was a game in which the solitude of it offered a kind of escape, I think, from tension and upheaval in my own life, from stress, you know, in my personal life. And I think the fact that The Witness is so consciously and deliberately evoking Myst, that it did in a nostalgic way kind of transport me back to some of those feelings. However, it very quickly gave way to something else. What The Witness wound up kind of illuminating for me, one thing that it really wound up illuminating for me, is just that the way in which we experience games now, or at least the way in which I often experience games, it cannot often be extricated from social media and from conversations that are happening around games. And I realized that, you know, in the era of Myst, that did not exist. You know, Myst, I didn't have Twitter. I didn't have all these people whose feeds I followed kind of posting about their progress, their success, their thoughts and feelings about the game.
So the isolation in the game mirrored the isolation actually playing the game.
Yeah, exactly. And it quickly became this thing where I couldn't escape from the conversation around it at all. And so that it was always kind of present for me on the island, my awareness of, these people have gotten that laser fired. They mm-hmm. have solved that section mm-hmm. or this person had, you know, thinks this about that aspect of the game. And given that this game is so much about trying to foster that kind of sense of isolation and solitude, the way that I was not able to kind of create that around myself and for myself while playing this game, I think in some ways actually it colored my experience of this game, because I wanted to escape, you know, I wanted to kind of escape to that island, and I wanted to have that sense of just being there with the puzzles and, mm-hmm. and myself, and mm-hmm. and I couldn't really create that for myself.
So how did it? It sounded like it interfered. Like what did?
Yeah.
What was the impact on your experience?
So I mean, the impact. Well, what it really did was, I think it brought up aspects in myself that I was not do not like very much. One thing that I often think about, or often thought about when I was playing The Witness, is the scene in The Empire Strikes Back, where Luke, is going to go into the cave and, asks Yoda, like, what's in there? And Yoda says, only what you take with you. And, I felt, for me, that's what this island became, is this place where it was just, I was bringing my own, like, loneliness and solitude and pride to the island. Because I would struggle with puzzles. And when I would struggle with a puzzle, it would eat away at me in a way that, like, I normally think that I'm good at puzzles, and I know that I'm capable of solving them, but I was just, because of the way in which I was struggling with my own kind of loneliness and isolation there, and it made the puzzles kind of become like these like enemies in a game that I just could not defeat. Like, I could not defeat them, because fighting them was fighting some part of myself that was just feeding off of my own kind of insecurity.
I wonder if you think some of these reactions, do you think the game intends this? Because I'll share my own experience as well, but it's pretty different than mine. And
yeah.
I'm struck by how the game, in its desire to create a contemplative space, in some ways asks you to leave a lot of your self behind to enter into its, its space, and to, this very cerebral, mental kind of way of being. And you're telling me something very different.
Right. For me, the wetness is a world that has echoes, I think, of the presence of people in a sense, but you are very much, alone. And as a result, like, the space just becomes filled with my own loneliness.
I
believe that what the game intends is to create that contemplative, peaceful space. It really was, for me, my internal contrast with my experiences of Myst and this game, which are so altered or shaped by the eras in which those experiences took place, both technologically, the technological differences, and the tremendous differences in my own life, that it's like, for me, it's like a, well, you can't go home again kind of thing. Like, that time has passed. But did it work for you in terms of creating a contemplative or peaceful space in which to keep those puzzles?
No, it did not do that, but it also, that's why I'm really interested in how it could create a space where you maybe bring things I don't think the game encourages in some ways, and yet you do it anyway, and which I think that we do all the time with games. We don't always, verbalize it or think about it that way, but this game was not deeply contemplative. What it was, at least in the first, 4 or 5 nights, it was far more pleasurable than I expected. So not being a fan of the way that many puzzle games kind of play out, I went in, cautiously optimistic here, but I found, surprisingly, given how much I hate so many video game puzzles, that I immediately liked many of these. I think because spatial maze puzzles are kind of like my thing. I'm very attentive to space in games. I'm always feeling that out and looking for interesting spaces. I was just thinking about, like, my favorite games last year, at least half of them are because of the space they created. And this one, it wasn't, I don't mean the island so much. I mean mazes, working out logic or kind of puzzling things, but visually and in space, my mind's kind of geared towards that. It's just like my wheelhouse. Like, I'm pretty good at, puzzles, I guess, in games in general, but these kinds in particular as a way of thinking about them.
That's super interesting to me, because I feel like that is exactly where a lot of my struggle comes from, is that I feel like, these particular puzzles are just... they are of a nature that I am not, like, particularly, that doesn't come, you know, solving them does not kind of come naturally to me or click for me in the way that so many other puzzles do. And, you know, I would be talking to friends about the game who struggled with things that I found very easy and who found things very easy that I really struggled with. And so that was super illuminating for me, just, I mean, that we do come, you know, there are different types of intelligence and different types of,
right.
You know, and so, like, for instance, there's the series of sound-oriented puzzles in The Witness. Mm-hmm. And I found those, like, extremely easy.
Oh, me too.
Right, but a friend of mine kind of struggled with those quite a bit, but, you know, he was able to complete, you know, whole sections of the game.
Well, did you feel any, like, I saw in, you know, online many people who would get stuck at places and would post screenshots and would be like, you know, what am I doing wrong and stuff? Did you not feel any fellow feeling with them? Because I think a lot of people had your experience.
So this is the worst thing that The Witness has made me contend with in myself is my stubborn fucking pride. because, and this is, I think, something that's, I've been this way throughout my life with pretty much any kind of puzzle-oriented adventure games. Mm-hmm. Like, I will look up things in a heartbeat to understand, something in you know, a Dark Souls game or whatever, because ultimately when the success is still going to be me holding the controller, fighting that boss, and I still feel like I own that success if, you know, even if I've gotten some knowledge from, you know, from reaching out to other people or reading things on the internet.
Right.
But I have this weird, I know this is a weird aspect of my personality. I own that. But I have this weird feeling that, let's say I look up something about how to solve, you know, a particular puzzle that I'm stuck on in The Witness. Mm-hmm. And then, but what if that, my fear is, what if that's like the little pebble that starts the avalanche of understanding that then gets me through the rest of the game? Mm-hmm. Then I worry that my whole feeling of victory or success will be undermined by the fact that I looked up that one thing, and I may wonder, you know, would I ever have been able to figure it out myself?
It seems like asking for help is different, right, than just, you know, looking up a walkthrough or a video for a particular puzzle, and yet you hesitate to ask people also, right?
Yeah, I do, because I still have that fear that it will, you know, whatever, even the whatever hint they give me, like,
it'll take away your ownership
exactly. Mm. Yes. And I am very reluctant to give that up for whatever reason.
Right. I don't think you're alone in that. I mean, I feel like what you're describing, maybe some of the reasons, you know, are specific to you, but I also sense that a lot of people, at least that I saw online talking about it, very much wanted to do it in a pure way, right? That there was some sort of way of doing it that was a better way or a right way to do it. And this is encouraged to some degree by some of the, you know, by some of the things that Jonathan Blow would say online.
Yes.
And it creates this kind of environment of, well, you know, a proper way to do things that I think that affects people to some degree. I think also other reasons, just like as you're talking about owning that victory or that solution. And yet that wasn't my experience at all.
Sure. So yeah, did you reach out for help or look things up when you were playing the game?
Well, I didn't reach out. I think I have more trouble asking for help rather than looking something up. Like asking for help, yeah, that would be a tougher challenge for me. Like I said, I think, you know, the early going of the game is pretty smooth, and then you eventually hit those walls, and they're different for different people. For me, I don't often have an experience of where it, I would refuse to look anything up. And so when I saw people saying that online, when I could see, you know, Jonathan Blow tweeting about it, I know why. I mean, the game is all puzzles. Like,
right.
If you take that away, there's not much, not really very much else. And so I wasn't interested in messing with that. At the same time, when I would see this kind of hardcore way of doing it, or, you know, keeping it real or pure, I'm not saying, you know, there's other reasons to want to do it that way, but when I would see that rhetoric, I would be kind of like,
oh no, I totally so. Look, I yes, I absolutely am normally someone who is very, you know, troubled by, I guess, that idea. And so, and then to sort of see that tendency in myself, because with so many games, you know, I'm very, I embrace a more kind of collaborative or communal experience. And yet with a game like this, you know, I'm not able to do that.
Well, it's interesting. Maybe we could talk about like why this game in particular could draw that out. Because like I said, from what I see people talking about, I don't think, you know, it's that strange to feel the way that you are and to do it this way. I think it is
partially, you know, because this game does feel like a kind of test.
Right. That's the word I keep thinking, yeah. Like that people seem to treat it like a test as well, a test they can pass or fail, and thus feel, you know, I think the most common refrain I see in reviews is, I feel like a genius, or I feel like an idiot. And that way that the game is designed to elicit some of those feelings, I find particularly, I guess, interesting, also a little frustrating, because that teaching element, I mean, games like this, and I feel this way about many puzzles, the kind of didacticism of these kind of games that people, I mean, it's baked in. I think that some of the reason you'd see some of the response online that would sometimes make this very personal about, you know, like about the designer, about, you know, I think because the game, it elicits that to a degree because it feels so designed. Like, you're never really as, you know, evocative as the island can occasionally be. It's such a designed thing, especially once the environmental puzzles come like into focus, that
yes.
It all hangs together in a way that, you know, it has a god. It has an intelligent designer.
Yes, right? It does.
This is not a world that evolved. It is not a world that, you know, came to be in any other way but through design. When you feel that designer, you know, and you feel that presence, you, I think, naturally kind of respond either subserviently or antagonistically, or, you know, a little like, did I please you, or you know, or fuck you, or
like Jim Carrey in The Truman Show, right. You know, trying to just kind of find a way to escape from the confines altogether,
right.
And defy, you know, what's expected of you.
So some of that response seems completely like in keeping with the kind of game that it is. Like, you don't play Minecraft and be like, you know, fuck you to a god in the sky, because there is not one. You
right.
Know that the god of the procedural generation is not the same.
Yes.
And that you don't blame, you don't feel tested when, you know, in the same way. And so I feel like that sense of a designer, if, you know, the author is dead in so many books, the designer is not, does not feel dead here. They
yeah.
If there's any presence on the island, it's the presence of design, right? And the designer. So I understand that reaction, and yet I'm you know, a fairly rebellious player. And so when I feel that, partly to the game, I can feel rebellious, but I can also feel rebellious to like the social elements going on around it. And in general, I'm not, you know, I don't have any rules I follow when it comes to, I'm not going to look something up. And there were a few times in the game, like I said, you know, it would go pretty well. But I remember the first time that I got stuck, and it was not just, I can't figure out this puzzle, but there's a part in the Tetris Swamp,
mm-hmm.
where you take a bridge over.
Yes.
And you can kind of do that before you're ready and hit.
Sure.
And I didn't realize the bridge could be reversed. And so I
was
trapped in an area
for
a while. And I didn't understand how the Tetris puzzles worked yet. I understood basically because you have to do a row of them before the bridge, but I didn't realize that there was another row of them on the back of that row. And I had gone on across the bridge without fully learning what I was supposed to learn.
That's interesting.
And so that was the first moment where I spent about an hour on two puzzles trying to get me out of there, not understanding the way that, you know, the puzzle pieces had to be in the combined space, but not in their individual locations. And that was the first time I was like, okay, I'm missing something here. I'm afraid I'm trapped. And I would, you know, looked up, can you get, you know, is there a place you can get trapped? And I saw a few other people in the same place. That was the first time I looked up, and then somebody said, you can reverse that bridge. And then I was like, okay. And then when I did, I went back across. And I didn't feel like anything was taken away. I was stuck. I gave it what I thought was a fair amount of time to figure it out. And, you know, there was maybe two other instances where I think,
as far as I'm concerned, you should still be trapped in that little area.
You're condemning me to that Tetris Island
experience. That would be the pure witness experience, man. You ruined it. At least for me, when a game world feels, you cannot have a game world that feels very designed without it all, in a way, then feeling kind of sterile.
Exactly.
Almost.
Sterile. Yeah. It suddenly feels frozen. It feels dead. It feels brittle because I recognize I'm both admiring the craft in putting this together in such a way to hide these things in plain sight. And yet recognizing how they so depend upon one another that you change one little thing and you've broken, you know, three environmental puzzles accidentally. And so I can both admire it and then step back and be like, this isn't a world. This is brittle. This is not supple. It's hanging together too much. It's like a net. It's like, it's screaming design at every turn in such a way that I'm suddenly like, I pull back a little bit and I'm just like, okay, what's this about? What's this for? Because I think it's looking, you know, like I said, the inspiration, Jonathan Blow has said that it was, you know, inspired by a spellcasting game. So it's invested in magic and in this magical moment where the world seems more than what it is.
Right.
It suddenly seemed less than what it is to me.
Right.
So it was strange, and it gets connected a little bit, I guess, to what I ended up seeing in the endings and where the game kind of goes. Because while I've described really enjoying many of the puzzles in a spatial way that, you know, like I said, it's not the... is the epiphany so much or feeling like I'm winning or something like that, but just lines and space and shape.
Sure.
I just really get into like that. Just, you know, whether it's the environmental like monastery puzzles, the Tetris shapes, or just dividing the lines between the black and the white, which they continue to do to the end. Creating boundaries. I feel the pleasure of that. And yet, the longer I played, the less taken I was with that. The pleasures were over. What remained, well, I'm not sure what remained.
Well, okay. Another thing that was kind of magical to me, that made those environmental puzzles magical to me at first, was the way in which they free you from the kind of sense of the limitation of the body, because it made me realize that one thing that I loved about Myst was that it came at a time in my life when I was overwhelmed with, you know, gender dysphoria.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the whole kind of conceit of Myst is that you, the player, you know, you're sort of playing as yourself or as a, you know, and that you found a book and that it transported you to that world. And I realized, you know, that was part of what was liberating to me about Myst, is that, okay, here's a world in which I'm, you know, if in the real corporeal world, my body is this thing that I feel is kind of jams the transmissions between me and other people that prevents an authentic or makes authentic connections with others very difficult. Here's a world in which I'm just, you know, free of that. I'm just my spirit and my intellect, you know, because there is no sense of a physical, you know, presence really in Mist. And so that moment in The Witness where you do go beyond the body itself was transcendent in that sense, too, the liberation from the body itself. Mm-hmm. That was powerful for me. I wonder if, you know, if the meaning of the game, so you've seen more of the videos, the theater clips and probably heard more of the audio diaries than I have. I wonder if there's a sense of meaning to the game that those things ultimately are able to create. Because my sense right now, of them is that while I find them individually very kind of philosophically interesting for me, so there's a feeling that the game itself is not enough, or that its meaning is not enough in and of itself, but it has to kind of reach for and kind of awkwardly graft these other writings onto it to grant it a kind of legitimacy or sense of great meaning, which
is strange because the game is otherwise so confident. I found it's a strange failure of nerve or something to me, that where the game is so much itself, so kind of uncompromising in many ways, so doing its own language, and yet it can't leave that alone. It has to bring in this overwhelming number of quotes and the videos. Some of the videos underground are so long. They're crazy.
Exactly. And I mean, I feel like there is meaning already in our relationship to the language of the puzzles, and in the way that the puzzles kind of at times have those moments where they require us to question our own assumptions about what a thing means and to rethink that, I just feel like the game's, it seems like this kind of a lack of confidence. Like the game has to assert that it's genuine art, where it can't just be confident in the meaning that its own mechanics kind of and environments create.
Right, right. So there's, on one level, there's this basic refusal to do the typical plot or stuff like that. And to some degree, I kind of get it, because I think a lot of games really trip up when it comes to the plot, when it comes to the audio diaries or the conspiracy or things like that.
Oh my God. It's audio diaries are the most inherently contrived way to tell a story.
Right.
I mean, there's all,
But even when the game can avoid that, which is full of pitfalls, two of the games that I played while playing The Witness, I'm really interested in the way that games inform each other, play off of what we've recently been playing or at the same time, or what we've been reading. And so while playing The Witness, I also played Life is Strange and Firewatch. And both of those games, to me, had problems of plot that make the anxiety that The Witness seems to have about that extra content that's not the mechanics or not the puzzles, understandable. Because for me, Life is Strange, as much as I, loved Chloe and I loved our relationship and I loved so many parts about it, once the bigger plot starts to kick in, I think that it loses what it does best. And I think that plot actually gets in the way and creates some problems that are completely unnecessary just get me back to hanging out with Chloe and you'll be good.
So games, the expectation even for a game to tell some kind of concrete linear story.
Right, right. And Firewatch would seem to be a game that is willing to resist that. And yet even it has the conspiracy plot that is, to me, a huge distraction. And not, from the core of that game, the relationship with Delilah, which is what I want to be focused on, and to have to kind of half the game to suddenly start kind of moving because of this, ultimately false plot, it's feel, and I was playing it, I was like, okay, witness, I get, you don't want to do this. You don't want to, you don't want to get in the way of yourself, right? You want to keep what you're good at good. And I get that, so that the audio and video and the witness feels, you know, extra. It doesn't feel like you, you know, you can miss the audio log. You can ignore the theater and
still have a complete experience.
Right, right. Right. So I get all that. At the same time, what it does have, what it does choose to put in there for the content is really limited and really, I guess, kind of misguided. There's a particular audio log. So once you go through the mountain and come back to the beginning and and then go back to the mountain to like unlock the secret path to a series of tunnels where the challenge is underneath. Mm-hmm. That series of tunnels is where like the kind of the audio, like there's, I think, five or six audio logs that are most, they suggest a kind of story. You know, they suggest, they're very oblique, but they suggest some of what's going on.
Okay.
And it's not much at all. I mean, it's not like there's some revelation to be had. But one thing that stuck out, it tries to dramatize the making of the game. And it's like kind of like they're talking about, people are talking, the voice actors are talking about which, like, quotes to include, and they start arguing about whether they should include anything about their own lives. And at one point, one of the voices, and I get that the game is trying to create a dialogue, is trying to have, you know, not all of the, you know, the audio logs agree with each other. They aren't all, they're not a single point of view, so it's trying to create a multiplicity. But one, it's a very limited multiplicity, and two, in that one I'm referring to, when they're arguing about it, one of the people says, like, well, if we get personal, you know, what's that but drama? And I found the word, use of the word drama so, you know, drama, like that's like, you know, what middle school students are afraid of, like, don't, let's not have any drama.
Right,
like,
right.
It's a weird way to think about human relationships. It's just drama.
It's like, right, I mean, the stuff of life.
Right, like we come from drama, our root, our being, like, you know, what's sex is, but not, right. Sex I is mean, drama. Like, you know.
Exactly, like, it is inherently dramatic to me,
right.
You know, I mean, to... friendships, relationships, you
right.
know, love. It's yeah.
To call it drama is somehow so reductive and so kind of like, I wonder if we're talking right. about the same thing. I remember reading an interview with John that talked about how, you know, he stopped listening to like Anna Karenina on tape because it was a soap opera. And I'm like, you know, if you think Anna Karenina is a soap opera,
right.
Wait, that's a...
Yeah.
No. Like, come on. Like that. If you there is insight, if you're just looking for like, you know, the nature of reality, it's there too, and it's in the nature of their relationships and the and our experience reading it. And soap opera, you know, all due respect to soap operas, like it's just kind of like.
No, for me, like the example that always comes to my mind from my own life is teaching A Raisin in the Sun to my students as an English teacher, and I mean it's. You know, I mean, you know, of course, every year there would be the students who kind of just found it, you know, boring. But I mean, it's like that is the stuff of life. I mean, this is about a family that is struggling with money and identity and society and the pressures of like, I mean, that I to me, it's like what can be more, you know, what can have more potential anyway to be truly like exciting than those kinds of dynamics and connections and conflicts.
Right. And unavoidable. Like it's like you can't get rid of them and just get to the serious stuff, the real, like, you know, the deep philosophical inquiry. Like I was struck by when thinking about all the audio logs, while they might have some competing viewpoints, it's still a very narrow, like, you know, slice of viewpoints. It's still, you know, physicists, not like biologists, like mathematicians, not writers, philosophers, not many artists, you know?
There's a very clear, like implied, I think, value about what is truly meaningful or important in the types of things that The Witness, you know, presents as meaningful and important and the types of things that it maybe doesn't.
Right. Right. That what's missing is the more I kind of thought about it, it made what's there, and you know, it's not like there's not some interesting ideas there, but the way they're presented, so decontextualized, And so just kind of like, we're just going to give you the main thought. It's like, we've distilled it down. We found this perfect quote, but it's really just an explanation. It has very little like subtext or subtlety because that's not its purpose.
So it's detached from, yeah, it becomes detached from whatever circumstances, you know, actual like flesh and blood human circumstances may have.
Those circumstances, even the circumstance of its own original text, uh-huh. You know, like,
right, that's what
one
I
of
mean,
the theater,
yeah.
Movies is from Tarkovsky's movie Nostalgia, and okay. So it shows this scene, which is kind of a famous scene of a man carrying a candle across a drained pool, trying to make it there without it blowing out. And it's, you know, it's a very powerful scene, but it in the movie, what's left out is it's preceded by a man who like sets himself on fire in a public square,
right.
And there just that piece missing. Like it makes, it's not that you can't use, you know, fragments and create like new holes, or, you know, you try to create a montage of different voices. But there is something in the way that these are excerpted and kind of decontextualized and
yeah.
meant to stand in for ideas, again, all on top of the puzzles. I mean, it's not that they don't sometimes relate to the puzzles, but they often don't. And they just, they're keeping on a conversation going that is, the longer I was with it, an increasingly narrow conversation, and one that seemed to strike me, like I said, just as much for what it's leaving out. I happened to be, while playing The Witness, also reading the book Blood and Guts in high school. Have you read that?
I have not.
Okay, so it's a book by Kathy Acker. I think she wrote it in the 70s.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm familiar with Kathy Acker.
Okay, so I had read it about 10 years ago, and I came across it when I was home for Christmas and brought it back with me and was just rereading it. Kind of, I started right before The Witness, not thinking it had anything to do with it. And it couldn't be more different than The Witness, believe me.
Yeah.
But it is a book that is so raw and difficult. And it uses montage, but it is trying to get at something real, often concerned with the body or the abuse of the mm-hmm. body. And it is a disturbing, but also just a really powerful book. And to read its, you know, blood and guts, as the title says, when there's not a gut in sight, you know, in The Witness, there's
like
a bunch of, you know, dopey statues that are, I've seen, you know, kind of mocked in places as they probably should be, because there's its version of humanity. That's drama, right? People are like reaching out to like the sun and you know, drama.
yeah, exactly. Right. Where all the humanity. Well, I was gonna say has been drained away, but it's like it wasn't even ever there.
Well, yeah. I don't know if it was there. I know it's gone through many years of development and had more of a story at some point. But I think the result is intentionally bloodless. I mean, I don't think that it's one where you would say that and they would be like, you know, the developers, oh, I'm trying to move you, and that, I think they might say, okay, yeah, we're not doing that. And yet, given the ambitions of this game, given what it's going for about trying to, you know, get closer to the nature of reality and
yeah.
our perspective on it, it seems to me that those absences are just very telling. In fact, the whole game
yeah.
was suffused with a kind of absence. There was something profound missing.
Right, I mean, it goes back to me too to how designed the entire
right.
and you know and sterile the entire island feels. Like I often like game worlds or games that feel, you know, as you know, rough around the edges, because
mm-hmm.
that because to me life is rough around the edges,
right,
you know.
Right.
So it feels more alive.
Right. Well, this. I like that too, and we can say that, you know, that's our preference, maybe. But I would want to go further and say that when a game is making, I applaud its ambition and what it's reaching for, but that means that it's when it's defining its concerns in its universe, that I'm going to take it that seriously and
mm-hmm.
bring myself to bear on it, but also bring to bear what I think is really important. I think the game seems to have this idea of some preconditions for meditation or for a contemplative space. And I kept thinking, this game, as pleasurable as some of the puzzles are, it is not putting me in what I understand as a contemplative space, but and other games have. Like I said, I played Life is Strange at the same time. And
there's moments in Life is Strange.
Absolutely.
Where, like, you're
when
just,
you just lay there beside Chloe, or you just lay in your own bed, or you just sit on a chair and you just let time pass. So you try to hold on to it. You listen to the song. You just exist there.
You inhabit. With, yes.
You inhabit
the moment.
Right. Right. And it's contemplative. It's emotionally contemplative. Right. It is. It is not, you know, just some, you know, unique idea. It is trying to be in a way that is, you know, the game posits as, like, you know, in some ways. It's a little, you know, I think imagines adolescence as a time that, you know, you can only have that and then you have to leave it, unfortunately. But I don't think that's the case. And and those were actually, you know, a true sense of being in a moment that I don't think The Witness ever achieves.
Yeah, they Life is Strange encourages you to really be present in a moment in a way that The Witness doesn't, for me, The Witness.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, it, you know, it's, in some ways, you know, Life is Strange is trying to do so many different things that it may feel like an unfair comparison. But if I think of a game where that is more kind of in the Witness's zone, but actually creates a strange sense of contemplation, I was thinking of a game an iPad game I played a few years ago called Zenbound 2. So... Have you ever played that?
I have not.
Okay. Well, it's, I came to it a few years, you know, after it even come out. And it's essentially, you know, in the game, you have various objects, like, you know, various wooden objects and different shapes. And you try to take a string and wrap it around every surface of the object.
Okay.
So that sounds very, like, straightforward. And it's surprising, given the premise, how... One, fascinating it is, and how little you know objects until you have to cover its surface area. Mm-hmm. How much you learn the nooks and crannies and the three-dimensionality of objects when you have to wrap it up with a string. And I found in playing that game that it creates, you know, by focusing us on objects, it's like this, you know, those simple but, you know, deep things. You focus on an object. You wrap your string or yourself around it slowly. And that to me is more contemplative than trying to use rules and logic and these various systems to create. In some ways, those get very convoluted and complex very fast. And it really kind of short circuits some of the resonant kind of being in a moment that something, you know, an iPad game like Zenbound 2 can achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. Simplicity, you know, and that kind of elegance and straightforwardness, I think, is very conducive to real. I mean, that's why again, you know, washing the dishes can be such a contemplative kind of present experience for me. It's like it's just, you know, the physical sensations, hands and water and the tactile.
Right. You need to touch every part of the every surface of the plate and the glass and. Mm-hmm. And you're working something through,
you know? Right? Exactly. And yes, absolutely.
So I was also thinking about, you know, if I don't think the content quote unquote on any regard from the statues to the audio logs to the video really work in relationship to the puzzles, I was trying to think about the puzzles and why they ultimately. Despite enjoying many of them, after a while, I began to feel like, well, ask myself, okay, so what are the mechanics doing here? What are the puzzles doing? And while they do many different things based on, like, the idea of each set, one thing they all seem to do, and this includes the environmental puzzles, is that they take, they work in 2D, right? So, I mean, we're walking around this 3D world, and we come up to these 2D panels, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And sometimes the environment, you know, connects to that. But in those cases, we are taking a 3D space and we are compressing it into a 2D view.
Yeah.
Right? And that's exactly what the environmental, you know, the environmental puzzles, you are trying to find the correct point of view in order to turn a three-dimensional thing into a two-dimensional thing. And that, to me, it's not just reducing or simplifying or abstracting three-dimensional space, but it's like a literal like flattening, turning things into a screen. And that is like, not...
Right, it's like you want things to go the other way.
Exactly,
Simplifying
it or flattening it in order to be able to do a puzzle, as good as those puzzles can be, that whole maneuver suggests a reduction of the world. That's why, when I suddenly started thinking about the environmental puzzles, and I was like, really cool, except you're reducing a three-dimensional island to a series of correct views for me to get in. And I'm like, huh, that is... I'm not sure that's going anywhere interesting. And I was thinking in comparison, what game does the opposite? And I thought of Fez, because Fez has a two-dimensional representation of a 3D space. And so to me, that game, while, it's not that puzzly in the same way, and it's, has other pleasures of sight and sound, but one of the things that I found evocative about it was that I knew I was always looking at an incorrect representation of its space. I was at a limited one, not incorrect really, but a very limited one. And the game it was playing on that limitation and me constantly trying to imagine 3D into a 2D screen, which is frankly what most video games do. Since I've been playing platformers all my life, I love to imagine turning and going into the background. Before we could ever do that, back when there was only 2D platformers before Mario 64 and all of that, I was still, looking into the screen and trying to reach, into it. I was like, pulled. And that's, Fez really like is built around that imagination. You're not really doing the recreating 3D except in your mind a little bit. And sometimes you just have to twist it a bunch of times. It's not perfect for doing that, but it is a different direction that I found continually evocative, that something that its core mechanic didn't exhaust or flatten it, but instead expanded it, like Portal.
I was going to say, I've been replaying Super Castlevania 4.
Oh, recently. I love that game. Yeah.
And what that's been doing for me is reminding me of how exhilarating it was when the Super Nintendo came out, because it allowed for 2D. So that game, it makes use of like mode 7 times. Right. And there's this kind of cylindrical...
Oh, that barrel roll. Yeah, level. Yeah, yeah.
The cylinder is rotating. Uh-huh. And as I'm playing that game, I'm remembering how... And I'm not just remembering. I'm like re-experiencing the sense of exhilaration at... Because it's still on a 2D plane, but it suggests three dimensionality in a way that games I couldn't up to that point. And because I'd always been someone who was also like really invested in these worlds, not just as like an area where you can run left to right, but wanted to push beyond the boundaries and transgress and see what else is out there. Like, so that is an expansive...
And that's just parallax scrolling, right? Most of the time, it's just simple parallax scrolling that we were constantly looking at and longing and thinking, there is more than what appears, right? It's this feeling of more rather than here in The Witness, ultimately, I feel like actually there's less than what appears.
So like, rather than like an expanding, this game, there's a kind of contracting.
Right, exactly. Like, And I think that ultimately, I don't think that was the intention, except perhaps to make the puzzles clearer, to keep it reduced such a way that, it serves good game design.
I think this game is, there's something this game is saying about perspective, but I think that a lot of what it seems to be saying is, to me, through some of the audio logs that I've heard, is almost like, your individual perspective is not...
It's trying to transcend perspective, like redefine, like you're trying to get like a non-person perspective.
Exactly.
I think that's what makes me so feeling like, okay, perspective, great, cool, but perspective is always bound in a body. It is coming from an embodied perspective. It's not pure sensation. A perception is something that has already been worked through in the mind, and it is informed by its source. But I am the source of that.
Exactly. And I mean, what's been, I mean, to tie this into larger discussions around video game culture that have happened in the past few years, uh-huh. The one thing more than anything else that has made so many of those conversations so challenging and difficult, I mean, issues of harassment aside, but just the core, like, ideas are, you know, being discussed, is that so many people don't see or cannot see the ways in which their perspective has been shaped or informed by their experiences or by cultural forces, and so they are invested in their own perspective believing it has a kind of objectivity to it, which it does not, you know, or believing that there's a kind of balance to the culture that exists that does not. And, you know, so I'm very suspicious, you know, or, you know, of anything that kind of suggests the attainability of a kind of objective perspective.
Right. Or even the desirability of it, even if it were attainable. But I mean, I agree with you. There is a profound sort of not knowing of oneself to pause, you know, to kind of put forth any, you know, talk about objectivity, because it just seems that if you can't see where you're coming from and you can't see what you're standing on and what the values you're bringing to play and your experience and all of that and how that informs the things, then you are just going to, I've said this before in a piece, that you're not going to see how much, you know, objectivity is either convenient for you or, you know, a cover for like just a dominant unexamined subjectivity that, you know, happens to mostly be white and male. It's a profound, like, unknowing of oneself. I guess before we kind of close down, I wanted to ask you a few other things, because one thing that I've seen in a lot of your writing and in my own is we use the word see a lot, to see someone, mm-hmm. to be seen. And here's a game called The Witness, right? And on a basic level, we are, you know, observing and witnessing the world around us, paying attention, which is, to me, a very admirable goal, to pay better attention. And yet the witness generally has other meanings. We witness a crime. We witness our faith. You know, we provide evidence, or they're the witness to a marriage. Witnessing is often very grounded in the human world. And so I'm just curious how the title kind of fell on you, given its idea of seeing or being seen. Like,
right.
Does it?
Well, I mean, for me, you know, witnessing, you know, or certainly seeing and being seen is, I mean, when I talk about those things, that is, I mean, getting at, you know, the core of my humanity or my desire for connection, which is to me, you know, central to what it means to be human, is the desire, the need to connect with each other in ways that are honest and deep and true. And
that
so,
sounds like a seeing that penetrates. It's not something that's like I'm observing just, you know, in a detached resort, but I am going through, I am trying to get at you and see you as a kind of like knowing of you, of a kind of like respect and a kind of deep investment. You know, it's a kindness to be seen or to see someone.
Absolutely. To be seen and then to be, you know, rough edges and all, right?
To be seen as a
flawed, complicated, you know, struggling person. It's very tied up in humanity and in human connection to me. And so I was certainly curious what the title was meant to evoke in terms of the experience of this game, but it never connected with any part of this game for me. Because to be a witness to something, there has to be something true and concrete and real to witness. And it's not just absorbing, you know, information or ideas, but there's a kind of presence on the part of the witness that is required, a kind of, in some way, you're participating or you're, you know, just by witnessing. And I never once in my experience of this game felt like, ah, okay, this is, you know, this is witnessing, or this is seeing and being and seeing something, you know, true and real and meaningful.
Maybe one more thing we'll talk about is just what role, you know, these kind of puzzle games have in gaming, because I feel like some of the things that the, you know, the developers here are really pushing back against, the limits they're coming up against have to do with the genre they're working in. So maybe I'll put it this way. So a couple years ago, I had written a piece for Grantland that it was about Candy Crush, but it was also at the end of the year kind of taking stock of some of the things of that mobile games of that year that I, some trends I'd seen or some just thoughts I had. And so one of the things I was looking at was two games by Simogo, Year Walk and Device 6.
Device 6, yeah.
So in that piece, it was just a short paragraph at the end of the Candy Crush piece, but I said, I called them the dead ends of the year. And what I meant by that was that the games both had a lot to recommend them, mostly aesthetic, but that they ultimately were just all the, you know, interesting aspects of the game were at the service of single solution puzzles. And I was suggesting that single solution puzzles, so, you know, these puzzles, kind of typical adventure game, puzzles, obviously not Tetris, not even Candy Crush, but, you know, these
like,
discrete puzzles, like in The Witness, like Braid,
right,
that they were dead ends because they induced in the player a kind of mindset that was, to me, antithetical to art, that you're trying to figure out the logic of, like, some, you know, single-minded designer god.
Right. So, and, I mean, it can be well-crafted.
Exactly, yes. And that it could, you know, it could be, though it often isn't, but that, you know, I was just talking broadly, using those two games as an example, that, you know, it really cuts against the ambiguity that would make those particular two games, given the kind of beautiful landscapes of Year Walk, and then these interesting textual, you know, play of Device 6, that it really cut against the ambiguity inherent to those things.
Yeah.
So anyway, somebody brought this to John's attention and said, what do you think of this?
Oh, okay, this is interesting.
Right, on Twitter. And so he wrote back and said, he's like, of course I disagree with this. I think the problem is that it's not that these games have, you know, puzzle, single solution puzzles in them, it's that the puzzles are bad. And so after that, I thought about that and, you know, kind of just wondered ever since, because it's true, I don't think the puzzles are very good in that. Mm-hmm. And it's true that actually when I think about most puzzle games, I don't think the puzzles are very good. I think that they're either the game engine or genre or whatever, like, you know, kind of history that we bring into making games comes first, and then you end up creating situations that the player has to, like, reverse engineer.
Yeah.
Or do these simple, like, they look around the environment and be like, okay, there's only so many things that can happen here. What am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. And those are, to me, not particularly interesting or good puzzles. They're
I mean, they've almost always, in my experience, been like a vehicle or just a necessary, you know, hoop to jump through.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You know, maybe in a point-and-click adventure that tells an enjoyable story with characters I like spending time with, but, you know, right. Anyway, but the game feels the necessity to have those puzzles because of the expectations associated with the genre.
Right. In fact, I think I said at the end of that little piece, like, it's like designers don't know what else to have us do. So they have to, like, put some stuff in there, you know, and puzzles are eminently designable. You know, like, they're,
yes,
Zelda...
They are game, quote-unquote, gameplay.
Right,
they are content. They make something that wouldn't otherwise be a game.
Right, and they don't even, you know, in a game like, and I've complained about in Zelda before, like where the puzzles are these kind of just very limited, simple environmental time fillers to me.
Oh God, yes.
So anyway, but I've been thinking the last couple of years, huh? I wonder if the problem is simply these bad puzzles. And that even when I think about the puzzle games I like Portal, it's not really the puzzles that I like about that game. I mean, they're fine. They're not particularly hard. But, you know, that game, if I think about a good puzzle game, it's actually because of the, you know, the writing in Portal, the character and environment with GLaDOS, the puzzle, the Portal mechanic itself, you know. The Portal is inherently so interesting as a way of thinking about space. It's an object of contemplation that, to me, you know, expands. You know, a world of portals is a intensely, like, evocative, you know, one that I'm going to keep thinking about.
Yeah.
So, that all said, I come to The Witness, and I think, how is this going to stack up, given that I have this problem with single-solution puzzles? Or, you know, maybe it would be more... In The Witness's case, many of them are single solution, but maybe it would be better to call them limited solution puzzles.
Sure, yes.
Because not only do some of them have multiple solutions, but even in a given framework, it's not simply one line. You know, there are variations on that, but it's still a limited solution puzzle.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? These are really good limited solution puzzles for the most part. I mean, not everyone, but there's like, you know, 500 of them, so they can't be. But... And on the whole, like, these are really, really good limited solution puzzles. Some of the best I've ever played.
Yeah.
And yet, it could be a great, great puzzle game, and I don't think a great video game. And so I was, this dead end idea, I thought, this is making me think back on my original thought. And instead of thinking, okay, well, here's a good puzzle game, so... negated. Instead, I kind of have a renewed conviction that limited solution puzzles are a dead end for video games.
And
I'm curious if that even, you know, you agree, or if it sounds like
I do agree. I mean, there were times when I was playing this game where I was thinking about, I was picturing how people, you know, I would sometimes see people on the bus or whatever, maybe carrying like a Sudoku book around with them, and it's just filled with Sudoku puzzles, and they sit there and they do the Sudoku puzzles. And I was actually thinking, you know, if some of these puzzles, if they were just like in like a book, you know, with a pen and paper, like I could totally get into them and enjoy them.
Yeah. Many of them could be. They would need a feedback mechanism, which, you know, the video game allows. Right. I mean, but in general, if there was a way to tell you if you're correct or not, like.
Right. I mean, obviously, I mean,
but yeah, they're reproducible.
Like having that kind of logic puzzle kind of, you know, satisfaction. I think a lot about the, you know, the difference between craftsmanship and like art and artistry. And I think that, you know, that things can be exceptionally well crafted, can be beautiful craft, and still be limiting and
Well, yeah, it is difficult to we don't, you know, part of us, I think, doesn't want to separate art and craft too far, because we understand how they inform each other, and that art is not, you know, it's not the idea of something, it's the execution of that, and it's the way that it all comes together. At the same time, there is something like you're describing with these books of puzzles. It's not that they, you know, this is not a video game. It obviously is, and it's not a very interesting question. But there's something to me, I just kept thinking of playing this and thinking, this is like edutainment. You know, that awful word. But it's like something like, this is didactic intrinsically, like deeply. And it is teaching something interesting, but it is still, it seems to me, to invoke this, what I guess maybe in games call like a solvability fantasy, right? It's this idea that the world is solvable, right? When we know that the world is not solvable. Art is certainly not solvable.
Art is not, that's it, yeah.
Right?
Art is not solvable. And that, you know, I've gotten so frustrated with this trend that I think has really exploded in recent years around how some people discuss or think about art as solvable puzzles, right? As the idea that, okay, there's some like solution to this, to the story of this movie or whatever, and that when you do that, when you figure out that piece of the puzzle and put it into place, then, you know, you've kind of won the piece of art. Solved it. But that's, to me, like, some ambiguity or mystery, or like, it's almost like essential to art, because, I mean, this is, you know, why rigid conversation systems in, say, BioWare RPGs, mm-hmm, where, mm-hmm, oh, if I do input X, you know, I will get the romance, and I will get the, you know, or get the sex cutscene or whatever.
Right.
As if, you know, that's not how, I mean, human interaction cannot be gained. Well, okay. Anyway.
It certainly can't, but it's also, it's because, I think partially because games have this transparency fantasy too, right? They refuse to, they like to lay their systems bare so that they can be manipulated. And they refuse to be opaque in a way that is really like powerful and useful, frankly, as a, you know, as a player, in engaging your imagination, in not feeling like you can see through to the structure of the world, and the structure is like, you know, a binary, like, you know, choice or something like that. So that's another kind of fantasy that seems to go right into, if the world is transparent, then it must be solvable. And that's, you know, patently ludicrous to me. So, well, it seems in games, it's particular, like this engineering mindset, or this way of this, you know, that you're going to understand something so well and solve it, and in that way own it, that it seems to me that, you know, engineering is a deeper part of game making than, you know, novel writing, as complex as that can be. And I wonder if, you know, the concern with answers and solvability and correctness is just this limit, particularly expressed in limited solution puzzle games, just made more obvious there.
Yeah.
But it's perhaps, you know, the reason that games and The Witness in particular still have trouble with claims, you know, wider claims in the public about art, or about, I don't know, it seems like this concern with rightness and correctness and answers, you know, really with winning too, that is, it's why, you know, to me, a limited solution puzzle game, like in its, you know, singularity and its disinterest in all the possibilities except its single correct one, strikes us as, it, you know, not, to me, not great art, not something that is
right.
Ultimately, you know, pleasurable and valuable, but something that is,
is somehow inherently not reflective of the sort of messier, more variable truth of human experience.
Yeah, and especially the messy truth of art, frankly. I was also recently rereading a book by Catherine Schultz that I think is really great, called Being Wrong, and it's all about the experience of wrongness. But one of the things it comes to in the end is really talking about how art and error kind of go hand in hand. And it's a great book, and it's it really, you know, to me, by locating art, and, you know, there are ways of thinking about science, you know, beyond the scientific method, that are, you know, to even go into the witnesses domain, where understanding the way that scientific discoveries are made and stuff like that is, you know, it's not rigorous or as systematic as it seems. So I don't want to, we don't have to go too far about it, but let's say, at least if art is deeply entwined with, like, human error, the sense of being wrong and of trying to be less wrong instead of, you know, being right, it just, you know, makes, again, art is not about winning. It's not about being right. It's, you know, to me, it makes The Witness feel like almost like an apotheosis, like this, you know, a high point of puzzle game making. But a potential end. It's like, it's so exhaustive. It's so,
yes,
so intensely what it's about. And it makes me feel like it took a game with like really good puzzles to make, to kind of reinforce my own feelings about
right.
the uses like, of puzzles yes, and the like, limits. I mean, the self-enclosed island, insular, you know, nature sealed off from life in a way that, you know, it's not that puzzles can't be a part of, but yeah. when they're the point, and I think that ultimately the lack of content, quote unquote, audio and stuff aside, really, but the way that the game points back to its puzzles, yeah. even as it warns against obsession, but it's still, it's about those puzzles. I think because these puzzles were in my wheelhouse, because they were like my kind of thing, I felt especially able to say that, hey, I like my Oprah aha moments. I like my spatial logic. I like, you know, all of that. And they suit me. And yet I don't think that's the way forward. Or I don't think that's the way to something richer or more ultimately like fulfilling in gaming or otherwise. And so by the time, like I said, once the initial rush of those days had kind of worn off, the game continued to sit with me in this way that, you know, I feel like I get it, and yet, and I feel like I'm prone to its inclinations and its values.
Yeah.
To a degree, maybe not its values, but it's kind of, I too am someone who stays in my house all the time and has a hard time engaging the world and likes to, you know, am aloof and pull away and mm-hmm. and be a hermit, like in a contemplative space. I get all of that. I know it, and yet I reject it. mm-hmm. So, you know, in a way that the game makes sense to me, and yet I
right. It's,
I
it's
the, I'm not going yeah. there.
No, I mean, the game seems to me to be encouraging a kind of a kind of cushioning of oneself from, yeah, again, like the messiness of real interaction and experience. And certainly, yes, I'm very introverted. I'm very reclusive. I like the idea of retreating into myself, but
as a philosophy of life,
I think that is a tendency that is a tendency of my own that I am working to push back against, you know,
right.
I'm like,
right.
I have to make the effort to go out into the world.
Right.
I have to make the effort to
right.
connect with people. I don't need to retreat like that. That's not where the meaning is.
Right, right. We're introverts. You need your time alone. Sure,
yeah.
I've always needed it. And yet,
batteries.
On a daily basis, I'm afraid. And I am, you know, I'm unwilling to validate that and somehow theorize it into something that is making it some ideal for others or even for myself. I think what gets lost in a lot of talk about games is simply the very different experiences that people have and preserving those or giving voice to them when kind of certain lines take over of, oh, here's the people who think that it's, you know, a brilliant, like, you know, best puzzle game ever. And here's the people who think that it is, you know, a hollow experience and a cruel and vindictive, taskmaster and all these kind of things, these fairly simple narratives when actually we are bringing our own, not just experiences, but, you know, where we're at. You are in a very particular place playing this game, and that absolutely informs not just your experience, but, you know, the witnessing it's asking you to do,
yeah.
right?
Yes, and then the game in turn informs the rest of my life in some mm-hmm. ways.
Right, they bleed so easily back and forth
yes.
Into each other.
Yes, they do.
Thank you, Carolyn, for talking with me. I really, really enjoyed our conversation.
My pleasure, Devis. Thank you so much for having me.